Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 preview podcast. And following its postponement last summer, the biggest international tournament in European football is just around the corner. And here at Squawker, we have got you covered. 24 teams, 6 groups, and now 11 cities in the first ever pan-continental version of the competition. We kick ourselves off with Group A. That's where 2012 finalist Italy will be looking to make the most of home advantage, and they're up against 2016 semi-finalist Wales alongside Switzerland and Turkey. And it's Turkey, that's where we get ourselves kicked off in Group A. My name's Fergal Brennan, and I'm joined by Football London correspondent and Turkish football expert Kaya Kaynak. Kaya, looking at Turkey, looking at the situation that they find themselves in ahead of the tournament, it's been a fairly barren few years. No World Cup qualification since 2002. There's been 2 European qualifications since then, but only out of the group stage once. So in terms of confidence amongst Turkey fans, amongst the team, the management, what is the situation at the moment?
Firstly, thank you very much for having me on. It's great to be talking about Turkish football here. And I think the general vibe going on around Turkey right now is one of quiet confidence. I don't think anyone's getting ahead of themselves or starting to believe that Turkey can go on to win the thing or maybe get to semi-finals, quarterfinals, etc. But I think there's a quiet confidence, especially given the results that we saw in the last international break, where obviously Turkey got a really good win against the Netherlands, really impressive win against quite a talented Norway side. And I think that has built up a lot of confidence within this team that they can definitely get out of the group stages, and then who knows where we go from there. I think a lot of people have seen what the manager, Şenol Güneş, has done since he took over, and he's had quite a good run. He's winning a lot of games. He's got good record against some big teams. You know, they're unbeaten against France, Germany, and of course the Netherlands, who we mentioned before. So there's lots of positives for Turkish fans to take. But of course, like you mentioned there, the Turks' record in big competitions isn't the greatest. I think the last time they did well in the Euros, you mentioned there, was when they got out of the group stages in 2008, got to the semi-finals that year and actually ran Germany really close. That was a massive event in Turkey. Everyone was delighted when they managed to do that. I don't think anyone's expecting anything similar just because of the number of quality teams. But I think Turkey have a decent bet, especially given the group they're in. There's a lot of teams that are relatively similar level. If you look at Switzerland, if you look at Wales, obviously Italy are the favourites. But I think Turkey are quietly confident of maybe getting through this group.
And as you say, you look at the results from qualifying, you look at the Nations League, the start to World Cup qualifying, that there are signs for positivity. This is the first back-to-back European qualification since 96-2000. They got second place in qualifying in behind France. And as you say, some positive results against, you know, the defending world champions. And given the fact that, as you say, Italy you would look at and say are the favourites for this group, Wales, Switzerland are potentially beatable. Do you think they will see this as a chance? It's been too long since Turkey have had a run in an international tournament. This is an opportunity.
Definitely, and especially with the Euros the way it is now, where the third place teams can go through the groups, I think Turkey will really, really fancy their chances. I think when it comes to those games against Switzerland and against Wales, those are going to be the key ones. I think Turkey aren't a team who are going to look to go out and try and control the game necessarily and try and play expansive football. I think the team is going to be relatively based on a relatively solid defence with, you know, that Premier League pairing of Ozan Kabak at Liverpool and Charles Arsenji, who we know from Leicester. And then they'll look to counter-attack with those attacking players who they've got pretty talented front line going forward right now. Obviously, Burak Yılmaz is doing so well at Lille, and plenty of other players, Hakan Çalhanoğlu, who's been doing pretty well at AC Milan this season as well. So I think Turkey would definitely fancy their chances of being able to get results up against teams like Switzerland, like Wales, sort of teams around their level. I think they'll view them as very beatable. And given the run they're on, as we mentioned before, they've only lost 3 games under the new coach, Şenol Güneş, who took over in 2019. So that's quite a long time, and it's quite a good run Turkey are on. I think they will really fancy their chances, especially of getting through in at least the third place position. Last time out, they had quite a tough group. Their group contained Croatia, Spain. So I think this time round, like I've said so many times, I think they'll really back themselves to go through.
And obviously, in this situation, you kind of build with your strongest foot forward, Soyuncu and Kabak in defence. That's relatively solid. Plenty of experience, Premier League and European, with Kabak at Schalke before he joined Liverpool. But the focus of the team is Hakan Çalhanoğlu at AC Milan. Obviously, the situation with his contract situation, whether or not he's going to stay at the club, is still a little bit up in the air. But with kind of seen his most consistent season in Italy in 2020-21, because he's one of these players that we hear a lot about and we know that he's got a lot of promise and that he has a huge amount of talent, but we're now finally seeing that bearing fruit in actual performances and something tangible for AC Milan. They've missed out in the title race to Inter, obviously, but he's been massive for them this season. How important is he in this Turkey team?
He's massive. I think the difference between what we've seen in previous years as to what we've seen now is he's really starting to enjoy his football. I think the vibe around AC Milan has been quite negative over previous seasons. And I think Calhanoglu isn't necessarily the kind of player who's going to drag a team by the scruff of the neck through difficult times. He's someone who will play well when things are going well. But I think when it's different when it comes to Turkey. I think you see this with a lot of Turkish players where they're devotion to the national team and their desire to do well for the national team often outstrips what they're able to do at club level. And Calhanoglu isn't really any different. He's someone who, for quite a while now, has been putting in consistent performances for Turkey. It does help for him that he's got a proper clinical striker in Burak Yılmaz up front. And there's other players now in the Turkish attacking line who are coming through. We talk about Yusuf Yazıcı, who's doing pretty well at Lille this season. Players like that. And a relatively solid midfield with Okan Yokuşlu from West Brom and Ozan Tufan, who's been doing pretty well for Fenerbahçe this season. So that does take some of the burden off him. There's no doubting that he is probably the most important player in this Turkey team, but I think he's relishing the fact that it's not solely dependent on him having a good game to necessarily do well for Turkey. I think he's really enjoying that. And like I said, he's starting to enjoy his football a lot more, which is a big thing for him as they go into the Euros. And he's full of confidence. He's a confidence player. He always has been. If you think about when he was coming through at Hamburg and he scored that amazing free kick against Dortmund, which I'm sure many of the listeners have seen years ago now. But when he's got confidence to try things like that, when he's got confidence to take things on, he can really be a difference maker in tight games like we're expecting against Switzerland and Wales.
And obviously, you say Burak Yılmaz is a key player up front. Cenk Tosun out on loan from Everton this season. He's got a serious injury. But before we touch on Yılmaz, Tosun was massive in qualifying. Top scorer, 5 goals. There would be no Euro 2020 qualification without him. What is the latest situation on him in terms of his injury? Is he likely to make it, or is it more than likely he's going to miss out?
It's not looking likely. I think he's out till the end of the season, at least for Beşiktaş. So that means that his chances of making the Euro squad are very slim. Turkey might be tempted to take a risk on him and take him. But if he does go, I doubt he'll be able to start in that first game against Italy. I think it'll be one of them where if he does go, he starts to get involved later in the tournament. Obviously, it's been very unfortunate for most of this season with that injury. If Turkey are able to get him fit for the Euros, fantastic. But I think they're in a position now, especially with the last international break where we saw they scored 10 goals in 3 matches. I don't think they're wholly dependent on Cenk Tosun like they were in the past when I think Burak Yılmaz was going through something of a bit of a wilderness in his career. But he's really having an Indian summer now. He's 35 years old, one of the top scorers in Liga. I don't think anyone saw that coming. So I think Turkey maybe got a bit lucky with the fact that he's come into such good form right at the end of his career. So I think they will be able to cope. Also, we talked about Calhanoglu. We've spoken about Yazıcı as well. Kenan Karaman coming in off the right-hand side. So they've got plenty of attacking threat if Tosun isn't available. But obviously, any team is going to want their top scorer from qualifying available in the massive competition if he's available. So I think that will be something Turkey will try to do. Whether they're able to do it, I'm not so sure.
And obviously, Yılmaz, as you say, has been fantastic for Lille. At the time of recording, they're pushing PSG for the title. He's been absolutely brilliant. But 35 years of age, this is more than likely going to be his last international tournament. He's edging closer to retirement at club level as well. But he has been fantastic. And he's got that ability to turn it on in big games. We've seen that, in a way, age is just a number for him this season. But if there's no Tosun in the team, there's a massive amount of pressure on him to be the key man up top. As you say, there's players around him that can get goals and create chances, but ultimately the weight is going to fall on his shoulders. And he is coming off the back of a very good season with Lille, but a long season with Lille. Are you confident that in terms of the goals that could be needed to just get out of the group, he can do it?
I am personally. I think he's really been really clinical this season. If you look at what he's been doing with Lille, I think he's been... I mean, lots of people thought his career was over when he went to China a few years ago. I think lots of people assumed when he left Galatasaray and he left the Turkish league that that would be him done. I don't think anyone really thought we'd hear from him again, especially in the top 5 leagues in Europe. But then he went back to Trabzonspor, had a decent spell there. surprise move really to Beşiktaş after that, and then an even more surprising move to Lille in the summer. And since then, it's gone really well for him, and he's been doing really well with Lille in Ligue 1. Like you say, they're challenging for that French title. So I think if Turkey needs to rely on him, he's already shown in the past that he's capable of doing it. I think Turkey have relied on him for a while now. We've already spoken about since sort of the 2008 tournament when they reached the semi-finals, there was a bit of a dearth in quality. A lot of players, sort of a gap in between the sort of the younger generation we've seen coming through now and the older generation from sort of the late noughties who ended in that tournament cycle. So Yılmaz has been the one consistent throughout that period, and he's been the one player who Turkey have always been able to turn to and depend on. Obviously, sort of in between the last two competitions, I'd say between 2017, 2019, he had a bit of a rough period, lost form. And I think, yeah, like we said, most people assumed his career was over, but he's really come back. He's done fantastically well this season. I think Turkey are definitely, well, I don't think they're going to have much choice but to rely on him, but I definitely think they're going to be able to rely on him going forward. I really think he's someone who can be depended on in the big moments.
And one other player that we haven't touched on that Turkey will be hoping can produce a little bit of magic is Kengiz Under. And you talked about this idea of bridging the gap between the very experienced players in the squad and some of the young guns that have come through the youth setup. And Under at 23, again, similar to one or two other players that we've mentioned, we've seen flashes of him. At Roma, he was very good. They've now sent him on loan to Leicester, where we've seen patches from him this season. And when he's been good, he's been very impressive. And Brendan Rodgers has looked to utilise him as an impact player, primarily off the bench. But again, the raw materials look there of a real quality player. In this type of group where it is going to be tight, Turkey are probably battling with Wales and Switzerland for second place. How valuable can he be as a wild card?
Potentially massive. I think if you've asked me a year ago, going into Euro 2020 as it was originally scheduled, I'd have said definitely Cengiz Under will be a key player for Turkey. I think this season really hasn't gone to plan. I've spoken to people who've watched Leicester a lot this season. They've been really disappointed with him as a signing. I think he's been viewed as something of a flop. He's not done well at all. He's been played in some of their Europa League matches, not really impressed, not had much of a chance to impact on the Premier League. So I think a lot of people were expecting big things when he came to Leicester, and it hasn't really worked out for him. So maybe he's less important as he was a year ago, but I think, like you say, he's still got all the raw ability. He's got a lot of pace. He can finish. He's capable of getting a goal when he gets into the final third, which in tournament football is invaluable. I don't think Turkey, again, will be relying on him as much as we've seen in the past, but I definitely think he's someone who will be a key member of the squad. And if Turkey are going to be able to get through this tournament and this group, I think key moments will be decisive. And I think players like Cengiz Under have the ability to really make a difference in those key moments, the ability to finish chances when they come along. So if he's selected and if he's involved, I really think Cengiz Under could be a key player off the bench.
First game nerves have been a bit of a jinx for Turkey in recent years. The last four European championships, they've lost the first game, and they don't come more difficult than Italy in Rome with at least 20% of fans that are going to be in the Stadio Olimpico. So given the fact that the record on opening night has been so bad, it's absolutely essential that they get something from that game against Italy. Or do you think that the Wales and Switzerland games could provide enough points to get through?
Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that. It was it's been a difficult watch for Turkey fans in the opening day of tournaments for pretty much my entire life. All I can remember is Turkey losing that opening game. So it's always been tough. But I think if you look back at Turkey's results against big teams in recent years, I think they've been able to prove that they can get a scalp. We saw in their Euros group qualifier, they got a draw with France. They got a win over France. We've already spoken about that. We've already spoken about the win over the Netherlands, which was very impressive. They got a decent draw with Germany. So Turkey aren't afraid to go toe-to-toe with big opposition. I think they're capable of sitting deep and hitting teams on the counter, being quite clinical on the counter as well. And so I think Italy are a team that Turkey will view as potentially beatable. I don't think this Italian side is necessarily as strong as the Italian side who we saw in 2012 when they got to the final. I think they're going through something of a wilderness as well. Obviously didn't really qualify for the last World Cup, but have a lot of good young players coming through. So I think Turkey, they don't need a result, like you were saying, in that first game. I think, obviously, any points in that game against Italy will be a bonus. But I think the main focus will obviously be on the more winnable games against Wales and Switzerland. But I don't think Turkey will necessarily be afraid of Italy. I think, especially opening night, all the pressure will be on Italy. First game, the whole of Europe, the whole world will be watching. And, of course, with fans back in the stadium, they'll want to impress. But I think Turkey will really, really fancy their chances of maybe getting a point and maybe even getting a win in that first game against Italy and breaking that horrible habit which they haven't been able to shake for years now.
Confidence, that's what we like. Right, so given the fact that some of the best third place sides will qualify for the knockout stages, if they don't manage to finish in the top two, Turkey, their record doesn't look great heading into this one, but there is lots of positivity based on qualification and based on some big results in the last 18 months or so. I think they're going to find it very difficult to get out of the group. Where are you pinning it? Where do you think Turkey can finish in Euro 2020?
I mean, maybe I'm biased in comparison to you with my assessment of it, but I do really think that Turkey have a chance of getting out of this group. I think if you look at a team like Switzerland, a team who like to have the ball quite a lot, a team who maybe don't score that many goals, I think Turkey will really fancy themselves against that. If you just look at what they did against Norway, who are a team who like to keep possession, Turkey were able to pick them apart relatively easily and be relatively clinical in that game. Against Wales, I'm not 100% sure. I think it'll be very difficult to tell how they're going to play. We don't really know what's going on with their managerial situation right now. And obviously, Gareth Bale is a world-class player. So if he decides to turn up, there won't be much Turkey can do. But across the tournament, I think Turkey will be confident at least of picking up 4 points in the group stages, which will definitely be enough for them to go through at least as a third-place team. So I think Turkey will fancy their chance of getting through to the second round, and then we'll see where we go from there. If they can get through to the quarters, then I think that will represent incredible success for a Turkey side who not many people really counting on to do well in this tournament. Personally, though, as a bit of a fan, I really think they can do something quite impressive.
Great stuff. Thank you, Kaya. Up next is going to be Italy. The Azzurri have shaken off their 2018 World Cup hangover, and they are back in business. We're going to be previewing them in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 preview podcast. Group A is today's focus and we are now looking at Italy. Joining me is Alistair McKenzie, Italian football expert. Now, Italy have survived the inglorious situation of not qualifying for the 2018 World Cup. That was described as a super embarrassing situation for Italian football, and they have called for the Batman. They've shined the signal into the sky and Roberto Mancini has taken over. Qualification for Euro 2020, safely assured. Roberto Mancini has got a bit of pride back in Italian football. But before we look at the squad and some of the calls that he's going to have to make in the next few months, or weeks, I want to talk about Mancini and the job that he's done. The situation of not qualifying for the World Cup in 2018 was super embarrassing for Italy, for football fans in the country. Mancini, as I said, has brought a bit of pride back into it. Just how big a rebuilding job has he done?
Well, I mean, first of all, just let me say I really like the idea of him being the Batman of Italian football. I haven't heard that one before, but I'm very much into it. it has been a kind of superhero-like job so far, just in the sense that where he picked up that team from and where they are now are poles apart. I mean, the failed qualification for the World Cup in 2018, like you alluded to, it was something of a national tragedy, really, and it resulted in a hell of a lot of kind of navel-gazing and really kind of deep conversations about what is going wrong with football in the country and how the national team has come to this and so on. And it really lost the kind of support of the people as well. And I think that was a huge part of it. It's a country that massively prides itself on its history and tradition of being a major player when it comes to major tournaments. Obviously, a glittering record in World Cups in the past. And this was the first time in 60 years that they failed to qualify. So it was unthinkable, really. And what Mancini's managed to do is incredible, really, because he's not only got the team getting results again, a run of results that competes with some of the greatest ever Italian coaches, like Lippi's 2006 World Cup winning team and Pozzo's team that won two World Cups in the 30s. I mean, those are the comparisons being made in terms of the results he's putting together statistically. But he's given the team a very discernible identity and style of play, which is something they lacked when they lost to Sweden in that playoff. He's brought through a new generation of young players who are really exciting people. And most importantly, he's got that public backing again. And as a result, all these things combined, Italy, the Azzurri feels like the Azzurri again. You know, it's kind of, we're approaching this tournament and there is a sense of kind of cautious optimism in the country that they can compete and actually, you know, play a major part in this tournament, even if they're not trying to pretend they're favourites.
And obviously, given the results, as you say, that he's brought since he's come in, fantastic record in qualification, 10 wins from 10. Belgium's the only country to do that ahead of the tournament. And when you look at, as you say, pressure and expectation, prior to not qualifying for the 2018 World Cup, there was a knockout stage in the 2012, there was a knockout stage in Euro 2016. So there will be an element of pressure on him and on the players. What is the public perception of where Italy can finish in Euro 2020?
Well, I think that we'll probably see that start to escalate and people's expectations inevitably start to escalate a bit the closer we get to that opening game against Turkey. I think as for now, so far it's been relatively reserved and, like I already said, kind of cautiously optimistic, because I think people are aware of how good this team is, how hard they are to beat, and the fact that they've got very good results under Mancini. But people are also aware of the fact that, yes, they were superb in qualifying, but it wasn't a difficult qualifying group. And they've not been tested by the very, very best teams in the world yet. They did win a Nations League group and beat the Netherlands and Poland along the way. But they've not kind of come up against your Frances and your Germanys and your Spain's or your England's of this tournament, who are going to be considered, I guess, the leading lights. And so I think that people are expecting them to get through this group, that's for sure, especially with three home games in Rome. And beyond that, I think the general sense is that Italy, being Italy, once they're in the knockout stages, and if they're so hard to score against, which they have been recently, anything can happen. Whether it's penalty shootouts, whether it's beating teams in 90 minutes, I think that you can't really rule them out against any team once it gets to the knockouts.
And obviously you say defensive record, we always associate Italy with a fantastic defence. They haven't conceded since October 2020, and it's likely to be Bonucci and Chiellini that are the cornerstone of the Italian defence. But behind them is Donnarumma, the AC Milan goalkeeper, who, for fans of Italian football, he seems to have been around forever. But in goalkeeping terms, particularly when you compare him to Gigi Buffon, he's quite young. But he will be first choice behind an experienced defence. What's the expectation of the role that he can have? Are you confident that, despite being relatively young for an international goalkeeper, he's got what it takes to be a real key figure for Italy this summer?
Yeah, absolutely do. Yeah, I mean, he's an amazing player, really, in the sense that he was promoted so young. I mean, it was Sinisa Mihajlovic in Milan who gave him his debut, I think, when he was 17 years old. And we've got so used to seeing him in that number one shirt for Milan by now that it's almost easy to forget quite how young he is. And when I've been asked for, you know, players to watch or young players in this Italy team, it's almost easy to overlook Donnarumma just because he's been around for 4 or 5 years now. But he is just 22.
Yeah.
And when you look at it, this is one of his first exposures to this level, to this kind of tournament, to this kind of pressure. Milan haven't qualified for the Champions League for the last 8 years, so he's not been playing in Champions League level football. He's been playing a hell of a lot of Serie A football and a bit in the Europa League, but this is going to be a new test for him. But he's a brilliant player, exceptionally agile, and for someone of his size, you expect him to be a kind of dominant goalkeeper in the box who plucks everything out of the air and so on, but he's actually an incredibly agile and energetic shot stopper. And yeah, I think that, like you say, it's the defensive effort is going to be a huge part of Italy's whether or not they achieve success in this tournament. And I'm expecting him to play a big part in that, because he can actually play quite a big leadership role as much as anything else. And, you know, with Buffon not being a part of the Italy team anymore, this will be the first major tournament without him. It's a bit of a changing of the guard, but it's the perfect changing of the guard, really, because you've got a ready-made successor.
Just looking further through the team in terms of midfield, Jorginho has come back into favour at Chelsea under Thomas Tuchel and kind of reminded Premier League fans exactly what a quality player he is. Nicola Barella is coming into the tournament as a Serie A winner with Inter Milan, but Marco Verratti, his season hasn't ended the way that he would have wanted to, defeating the Champions League semi-final for PSG against Manchester City. And there was a little bit of a black mark against his name in that game. He lost his cool a little bit. And as one of the more experienced figures in that team, he kind of let himself down, particularly in the final stages of the second leg. But he is absolutely central to this Italy team. And with Verratti, for fans who don't watch him on a regular basis, there always seems to be this idea that he's underachieved slightly from the level that we expect from him, from the profile that he has. Does this tournament offer him a chance to remind people exactly how vital he is to Italy?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, really. I think there is almost an expectation or an impatience to see Verratti become this this complete fulcrum to the Italy side and become this leader and this key man, really, at the centre of everything that's good about this Italy team. And he's been that so far in qualifying and so on. And so obviously it's going to be a step up for him to bring that to a major tournament. But, you know, at 28 years old, with the experience he's had by now with the national team, but also, as you alluded to, in the latter stages of the Champions League for a team like PSG, I think he's at the stage of his career where this is really his opportunity to say, right, this is me at the peak of my powers, and here I am to take this team by the scruff of the neck and take them deep into the tournament. Because for me, Verratti, I mean, it's a hard team to identify one key player for, because there isn't necessarily one outstanding star player for this side. But for me, I think he plays an absolutely key role in the team, because he has that combination of abilities where he can create, he can pass, but he can do all the dirty work, the hard running. He can be basically two midfielders in one when he's at his best. And I think alongside Jorginho and Barella, two very technical players, Italy have been almost impossible to take the ball off. And even when they have been playing higher level opposition, be it the Netherlands or Poland and so on, they're still getting, you know, nearly 60% possession in a lot of those games. And that's almost as much as the defensive efforts of the Chiellinis and the Bonuccis of this world. Just keeping the ball is helping them keep that defensive record so good as well. And that midfield, that midfield three is better at that than almost any other in the tournament. So I think it's a huge tournament for Verratti. And for me, I think as long as he can stay fit, I know he's had an injury recently, I think that he's going to be fundamental to Italy achieving success.
Obviously, you know, we've touched on the defence, Donnarumma, Chiellini, Bonucci, and the fact that we expect Italy to be very, very strong at the back. But ultimately, in attack, there is still question marks over how Mancini will set the team up, who will be the go-to man to get a goal. And as it stands, it's likely to fall to either Andrea Bertoli or Ciro Immobile from Lazio. And both of them, whilst impressive in Serie A, and fans of Italian football will sing their praises and how regularly they get on the score sheet in Italy, but there is still a little bit of a nagging doubt about their ability to do it on the big stage. And particularly if you're looking at a knockout game for Italy and they need a goal and they need a bit of a spark from one of those players, is there a concern that they're up to it, or is that just from the outside looking in?
No, I mean, the Belotti-Mobile debate has really been the biggest of all the debates around the national team, and the biggest, I guess, of all the doubts people have about the Italy team, you know, inside and outside of Italy. And it's a strange thing to say, really, because Immobile has been the most consistent goal scorer in Serie A for the last 5 years. He's scored an outrageous amount of goals at Lazio. Last season, he equaled the all-time single-season scoring records. He's been doing it in the Champions League this year. Belotti, likewise, he's not flourished at Torino as much as he could have elsewhere, because he's always been fighting a losing battle in relegation or lower table team. But neither of those guys play in the same system that they do with for Italy. They both play in 3-5-2 formations usually and have kind of more creative players closer to them. Whereas for Italy, they're expected to kind of spearhead that three-man front line. And it's a different role it's something that Mancini's still not really settled on. It's chopped and changed quite a lot as time's gone on. Immobile is, I would say, is the first choice if he's in form, but he has struggled with confidence with the national team. He was criticised a lot after the failure to qualify for the last World Cup. His confidence took a massive hit from that. As a result, he went on a very long dry spell with the national team. And he's only really been starting to kind of build that confidence back up again. But his performances with Italy are unbelievably microscopically analysed by everybody who watches them because of this debate. I think that for him, for example, when you're talking about knockout stages and needing players to score big goals, I think he would benefit a lot from starting well and taking the momentum from a group stage into the knockout stages. Because I think if he can start the tournament well and get a couple of goals under his belt in those group matches, he is far more likely to be the player that everyone expects him to be or everyone sees him being at Lazio. So, yeah, but it will be interesting to see how Mancini handles that, whether if Immobile has a bad first game, he immediately changes to Belotti. If he gives, say, a Ciccio Caputo or a Moise Kean a chance, it's going to be interesting to keep an eye on that selection.
And you've touched on something in your notes, not even on the pitch, off the pitch. Something that we missed from the 2018 World Cup was the passion of the Italian players, obviously the passion of the Italian fans as well. And the sight of the Italian team standing there belting out the national anthem was something I definitely missed in Russia. How big will that be in Euro 2020? You must be looking forward to hearing those first few notes.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it's just an iconic part of a major football tournament, isn't it? It's when you see, whether it's kind of Buffon, Chiellini and Bonucci, that lot together, arm in arm, screaming it out. And it's always, for me, a real highlight of these tournaments is seeing the Italian anthem, because they sing it like most teams don't. You're used to seeing national anthems being sung and everyone's just kind of either ignoring it or just not really engaging in it. And that's not something you get from Italy. So it's always, for me, a nice kind of part of the major tournament is seeing them singing like it's the last thing they're going to do on earth. And and the other thing too is, of course, that we're going to have 25% capacity at the Olimpico, so that comes to about 17,000 fans. And being able to actually have that kind of national pride and passion that they always have anyway, but on top of that, they're going to be playing in front of fans for the first time in about a year and a half by then. So I think that's going to be, it's going to be huge and hopefully can really help them and make the most of that host nation status.
Okay, we're going to get you to nail your colours to the mast. Home advantage with fans back in the stadium in Rome, back in the big time, back in a major tournament, rock solid defence. You are relatively confident that Immobile will prove some of the doubters wrong. I've looked at the map and where I think Italy will possibly end up. I'm going for a tentative quarterfinals. What's your word? Where do you think Italy will finish up this summer?
Quarterfinals wouldn't surprise me. I think that they're if you look on form, they're kind of on course to meet Belgium in the quarters. And what I can immediately see happening is Romelu Lukaku scoring the winner against all of his Inter teammates and winding up everybody in Italy who's been singing his praises for the last 2 years. I think there's a chance of them getting as far as the semis, but if I had to put money on it, I'd probably go quarters as well. I mean, I can see them making a mark in this tournament, but maybe not enough of a mark to go all the way to the final. So if I'm being optimistic, yeah, why not? Semi-finals.
Great stuff. Fighting talk. Italy fans, it's not your own players you need to concentrate on. It's the man who normally wears black and blue stripes, Romelu Lukaku, that's possibly the biggest danger to Italy in Euro 2020. Alistair, thanks very much.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great stuff. And up next, after the break, we are previewing Wales, the 2018 semi-finalists, looking to make another big splash this summer. Hello and welcome back to the Euro 2020 Group A preview. Next up is Wales. The Welsh are looking to continue the 2016 party in Euro 2020 this summer. I'm joined by Welsh football journalist Hugh Davis. We're looking ahead to what will hopefully be another big summer for Welsh football. But before we get into this summer, let's cast our minds back, which amazingly now is 5 years, five summers ago to Euro 2016, and Wales marching all the way to the last four and just slightly coming up short in a push to get into the final and maybe even get their hands on the trophy. But it was still such a massive story, massive success story, huge amount of feel-good factor surrounding Chris Coleman, who was the then manager, and the players. Has that positivity remained with the team in the years that have followed? And is it just a case of reigniting that fire this summer?
I think it's certainly about reigniting it. The positivity, as you can imagine with a lot of national teams, has kind of ebbed and flowed. There was a huge high after that, going straight into kind of a rare thrashing of Minnow and our first qualify for World Cup 2018, which never happens. But then, of course, we didn't qualify out of a fairly weak group for 2018, which put a dampener on things. And then Coleman left. And a year after that, Oshan Roberts left, who's a very important assistant. So that was kind of tricky. And Giggs's appointment was not met with universal approval. So there was kind of a time where things were looking a little bit shaky. But then the last, 18 months, 24 months have been incredibly positive. Qualifying for Euro 2020, really good Nations League showing, and then a decent start to kind of qualifying for World Cup 2022 as well, has brought that kind of high back. And now there's a sense that, we can try and carry something into the tournament this summer.
Obviously, with 2016, there maybe isn't the kind of flying by the seat of your pants excitement that there was in that tournament, but there has been a lot of steady progression, getting through a difficult qualifying group. It was kind of a straight shootout with Slovakia, really, for second place, in behind an impressive Croatia team who, reached the World Cup final in 2018. And then, as you say, that's rolled into the Nations League and into the World Cup qualifying. Prior to 2016, even the most optimistic Welsh fan wouldn't have said semi-finals minimum, let's go and see if we can win it. But with performances like that, and with positivity, and with some of the important players that you've got back fit and raring to go this summer, inevitably there will be a bit of expectation. Do you think that serves as a positive to motivate the team, to motivate Rob Page, who'll be taking charge of them this summer? Or bizarrely, do you think it could be a little bit of a hindrance? Do you think there are fans that are thinking, not necessarily semi-finals last time, final this time, but that there'll be an absolute demand for at least a knockout place finish?
I mean, there is a certain generation of fans who've inexplicably not known the kind of dark years and will actually kind of complain at nil-nil.
Very lucky.
After an hour. I mean, I'm not that old, but I'm old enough to know that it's not always great. But I wouldn't say expectations are so high as to be damaging, though. I think I take your point how that could be the case, but it's funny how you mentioned flying by the seat of the pants in 2016. We've kind of been doing that a lot over the last year or two. In qualifying for this tournament, we left it up to needing to get those results. You said it was a kind of shootout with Slovakia. Because we'd lost two of our first three games, we kind of went into games, right, we've got to win this one, we won it. Got to win this one, we won it. And then it went down to a showdown, got to beat Hungary, and we did. The same thing had happened in the previous campaign, trying to qualify for the World Cup. And we'd left it all to do. Got to win those last four games. Win three of them, come up, all or nothing, and then lose to Ireland. This time we've kept that momentum. We've won every game that needs to be, but you just wonder how sustainable it is. Can you go into every game needing to win that because of earlier faults? Winning it by one goal, often a late goal. Wales have scored winners in the last 10 minutes, I think, of four of the last eight competitive games. And it is flying by your seat of your pants, and that's wonderful for momentum. But if you kind of have to sit down and look at it, you wonder, is that an approach that we can sustain going into a tournament? As for expectations, though, I think they're kind of healthily positive. I don't think there's going to be huge inquests if it falls short. But obviously a group stage exit would be disappointing because we're so much shorter of last time. But I think once into the knockouts and see where it goes, I don't think there's any expectation of, right, now let's go and win the thing, especially in a difficult group.
And obviously looking at the squad, and again, we keep kind of harking back to 2016, and you look at the lineup from that famous semi-final defeat to Belgium, some of the names that were included in that won't be in the squad this time round. And alongside that, you've got some key names who were involved that are potential injury doubts for the tournament. Joe Allen, Aaron Ramsey, who's obviously now playing his football in Italy with Juventus, and Ben Davies at Tottenham, as it stands, are all still battling with injuries. They haven't played a massive amount of club football in the last couple of months, but for Wales, for Page this summer, they're still massively important. How confident are you those three and some other key names are going to get off the treatment table in time to be included in the squad?
I mean, obviously, I don't know the specific situations of their injury. What I could say is that Wales are better now in the last, say, 6 to 12 months at compensating for absent players. I mean, people love to quote the statistic about Wales not winning a game without Ramsey or Bale for however many years, but that was just because they played so many games together. Now we're actually capable of winning these games. Ramsey's only played 3 of our last 21 competitive games, only started 2 of them, and we found a way to win those matches. Bale has been kind of pretty much ever present, which says a lot about his attitude towards the team. Ramsey has a great attitude towards it as well, but has picked up so many different kinds of injuries and has fatigue issues. So Wales are better positioned now than we were in 2016 in terms of replacing players. In 2016, we went in with Joe Ledley having broken his leg a month before, which is preposterous that he came on in the first game after breaking his leg. And Hal Robson-Kanu was also kind of coming back from an injury. And they were just two first-team players, not absolutely vital players. And yet we went into that tournament going, we need to get them back. How are we going to replace them? Now we want to see everyone fit, and I mean, losing the players you mentioned, we would hugely miss them, but we have another plan. We have an alternative plan. I mean, I actually wonder how Ramsey's going to fit into the starting of 11. If he's fit, he'll play. He'll definitely start. But Wales have kind of gone towards a 3-4-3 of late, and then it's a question of, well, then is he replacing a holding midfielder, or is he playing in a front three where he doesn't really belong? Are we going to change the tactics back to the 4-2-3-1 when Ramsey was in the side just because he's available again? Wales suddenly have a lot of options, and so certainly more options than we did. And so while we want those players fit, there's almost this sudden luxury of, well, hang on, we're going to be leaving out some good players. I was trying to pick the starting 11. If everyone's fit, does Alan get in the team because he's had to kind of be deputy to Joe Morrell for so long, and always one or two of Harry Wilson, David Brooks won't start because one or both because of the players we've got. It looked like Kiefer Moore was going to be the most important player. He came in during qualifying and completely transformed Wales. We didn't have any kind of focal points. We struggled to make those striker runs, and he was superb. He wasn't just a target man. He kind of made excellent movement, brought other players into the game, helped Bale kind of get into the game more, and scored goals. And then as of the autumn internationals last year, suddenly he's back to being plan B again, and we're playing Harry Wilson as a false nine. Harry Wilson, who is not 6'5" like Kiefer Moore is, and Dan James playing a number nine sometimes, all 5'7" of him, scoring a header against the Czech Republic to win the game late on. So those players are key. They are massive. Bale has that X factor, as we've seen in games, including against the Czechs. He doesn't have to score. He can just whip in an absolutely perfect cross for a tiny player to score. They do have that X factor. Aaron Ramsey, in the only game he started of the qualifiers, the final game, started it, scored twice, and we won 2-0. They have that ability to raise their game and snatch important results, but Wales finally do have a way of compensating for not having their key players, which they haven't.
When you look at the team, and obviously, as you say, there's been a lot of changes, and some of that has been positive, some of that is negative. Sometimes having too many options, particularly in certain areas, can actually be a bit of a headache for a manager to pick between, because inevitably it means certain important players being left out. But someone that's kind of stamped their mark on the team, and regardless of injuries, is likely to start is Ethan Ampadu. Obviously not a brilliant time on loan at Sheffield United this season. They've been relegated, but when he's played for Wales and in fits and starts with Sheffield United this season, we've seen the class that he's got in that deep lying midfield area. He can win the ball, he can get possession moving quickly. And when you look at behind him with no Ashley Williams and less experienced defence that he's going to be protecting, there's a lot of weight on his shoulders, but he's demonstrated that he is up to the job.
Yeah, he's a really key player for Wales because he's got a versatility that allows Wales to change systems mid-game. And I know that sounds like a backhanded compliment. Oh, he can play in different places. Well done. But actually, it's key because, yeah, he's usually protecting that defence, whether it's a back four or a back five, and giving that protection and kind of slotting in deeper to play pinpoint passes up the field, which is something Sheffield United didn't really see. I think a lot of their fans were a little bit disappointed in what they saw, which is understandable. He started there. It started very badly. He was played in 4 different positions all told, I think, and they have that unique system. He's just never been a centre-back who's going to charge up and suddenly be on the right wing. Not many players are used to doing that, but he found his role there eventually. For Wales, he's generally a holding midfielder but can happily slot in at the back. And yeah, he will be essentially a must start. I mean, he's still 20, and he'll be 20 at the tournament, and he's got 20-odd caps which is remarkable, really, for a player of his age. But he's got that kind of maturity on the ball. Off the ball, he can occasionally be a little rash. He loves a kind of a bizarre foul, which has to be watched in tournament football, where pointless yellows can get you, well, as it did with Wales in 2016, key players missing a semi-final. But his kind of reading of the game and ability on the ball is really useful. Well, it's superb, really. I think he's one of Wales' best talents in years. And yeah, he does give Wales options with different formations as well, even changing mid-game as they often do.
And obviously, we've touched on him slightly, but the man that we have to talk about, Gareth Bale, he's made no secret of his situation at Tottenham and his dedication, his ongoing dedication, as you touched on before, to Wales. And he's essentially said that Tottenham was a bit of an early season training camp to make sure that he was fit and raring to go for Wales this summer. And obviously, Wales fans listen to that, and it's become a bit of an inside joke, but it is incredible for a player to be that much more committed to their national side than their club side, be that Tottenham or Real Madrid. You know, we all remember the flag. Given the fact that it's not been the best season for him at Tottenham, particularly under Jose Mourinho, Ryan Mason has brought him back in and looked to put a bit more faith into him. But he is the talisman for Wales. As you mentioned, when he's on form, which he generally is for Wales, he is a world-class individual that can drag performances out of other people. And in Euro 2016, 3 goals in the group to get Wales out of the group, including that famous free kick against England. And he was a talismanic force. Can he drive Wales on again this summer? What can be expected of him? Because people will look at his performances from Tottenham this season and say, this isn't the Gareth Bale of a few years ago, but when he pulls on that red shirt, he is the Gareth Bale from a few years ago.
Well, they'd be right in that he isn't. He's not sprinting down the wing. He hasn't done that in 5-10 years, and he's not always able to kind of take a counter attack from deep. What he can do is take defenders on. Still, it's in a different way. He kind of will cut inside, and he's capable of beating them. And he's a threat from anywhere. I think his crossing's often forgotten, but his crossing and his shooting, there's kind of nowhere on the pitch where a defence is entirely safe with Bale on the ball. He can conjure up a moment out of nothing. And Wales tend to live on the margins. I mean, Wales' results are, any wins are almost entirely by one goal, sometimes two. Wales, apart from the Belgium game in March, was the first time Wales have conceded three goals in a competitive game since 2013. They kind of keep things tight, win games by one goal margins, and having someone who can pull that off. And of course, that's what Dan James can do and Harry Wilson can do, and these players who know how to produce something special, they can offer that. He's a big target in the air, as we know. He's also, don't joke, got a fantastic throw-in. He's just fantastic throw-ins and scores free kicks, although so does Harry Wilson now. He will be key. He's a key player. As for his Spurs form, I don't think he will be as worried as all that. I think some Spurs fans were naturally a bit disappointed because of how they remember him, but I think they also recognised that he was underused by Mourinho. And then you see what he can do when he comes up, pops up and scores a hat-trick. His minutes per goal ratio this year is one of the best in the league, I think. It might even be the best in the league, or one of the top two or three in terms of how often he's played and his kind of minutes per goal contribution, goals and assists. And so often he was just kind of given 5 or 10 minutes to save a game. And while you can't really expect any player to do that, he came pretty close. I mean, the humiliation in Croatia, he went at 2-0 down, and so Spurs needed something back. He actually put in a cross on a plate for Kane to score from about 3 yards out, which somehow didn't go in. Spurs gone to lose that game 3-0 and go out, and it's, I said, humiliating. But he did what was asked of him at that point and made a key moment out of nothing. He's not going to be coming on as a sub for Wales. He'll be starting games, and he'll run himself into the ground as he always does. But he'll be offering a threat from pretty much anywhere. And of course, that ability to win free kicks for either himself or Harry Wilson to take and score.
And looking at the group in terms of, particularly in comparison with Euro 2016, 2 wins, 6 points was enough to get Wales out of the group then and then power them on to the semi-finals. But this time round, Italy, despite the fact that they failed to reach the 2018 World Cup, would be seen as the powerhouse in this group. But alongside Switzerland and Turkey, who've not endured the best of campaigns in terms of qualifying or Nations League or World Cup qualifying, there seems to be an opportunity for Wales here to get out of the group and then, as we all know from Euro 2016, once that happens, all bets are off. Where are you looking at where Wales can realistically finish this summer?
I think a realistic hope, as in kind of I would be happy with, would be, I mean, obviously you want to go as far as you can, so it feels like a bit of a strange thing to say, but I think I'd be happy with quarterfinals or beyond. Second round is my expectation. Group stage would be disappointing. I think actually, in contrast to what a lot of players would say, I think winning that first game is crucial. I interviewed David Brooks a couple of months ago, and he said, obviously all the group stages are important, but you don't want to lose your opening game. And because then you're playing catch-up. I think with the way the format works, with 16 teams going through from 24, winning that first game would actually be huge. Because if you draw with Switzerland, oh yeah, good result on paper, you still need to beat Turkey or Italy. You're unlikely to go through with three draws. Yeah, Portugal did in 2016, and that turned out pretty well for them. But you can't really plan for that. You've got to win a game in your group stage. And I think if you get that against Switzerland, you can then relax in the next games, as Wales found... having beaten Slovakia, it took a huge load off and sets you up going into the tournament. A draw just kind of delays that pressure. Mm-hmm. And I also think that Switzerland have sometimes flattered to deceive under Petkovic. Shaqiri's lacking in football. Sorry, my alarm's going off. Shaqiri's lacking in first team football this year. I think that's a team that can potentially be got at. And Turkey are just very difficult to predict. I mean, you're right, their results hadn't been all that. And then suddenly... they're beating the Dutch and winning 3-0 in Norway. And you're thinking, oh, God, hang on. Have we got three teams in great form? And then they drew with Latvia. So it's really hard to know what to expect from Turkey. So that's how I'm looking at it. And as you say, all bets off when you get into the quarterfinals. I think if Wales go through first or second, they'd probably have a decent chance of playing not a giant. Going through in third, and obviously you've no idea. So... I think winning that first game is massive. You don't want to go into the Italy game needing anything, as it being an away game.
Yeah, I think if the scenes from Euro 2016 can even be half matched by Wales this summer, it will be a hell of a summer to be a Wales fan once again. Hugh, thanks so much for joining us.
Cool, thank you.
Great stuff. And up next, we are going to be previewing Switzerland in the final team of our Group A preview podcast. We'll catch you in a second. Hello and welcome back to the Euro 2020 Group A preview podcast. And to wrap up Group A, we have Switzerland. The Swiss are through to their fourth European Championship in five attempts. Relatively solid record from Vladimir Petkovic's side. And I'm joined by Swiss writer Matthew Volthart to look ahead to the tournament and preview what we're expecting from Switzerland. Matthew, in terms of qualification, it wasn't the most exciting, but... very much a case of job done, box ticked, eventually saw off Ireland, who, as an Ireland fan, Ireland and Switzerland seem to have played each other every year for the last 500 years. And Switzerland generally have got the better of Ireland. And that was the case there in qualifying for Euro 2020. So looking at the picture ahead of the tournament, solid, if a little bit unspectacular, what is the mood in terms of Swiss fans? They're well used to qualifying for these tournaments in the last couple of decades, but generally haven't really impressed when they've got there. Is that the expectation this time round?
I think that's the big worry, and your assessment of qualifying was pretty spot on. I think it was a pretty near thing for a while there. They had early into the campaign, they had a big lead on Denmark, and they blew that. They were up 3-0. And conceded three goals in the last 5 minutes of the game. And the same thing happened later with Ireland and again with Denmark, where they had leads or headed for a draw and gave away points in the last couple minutes. So not overall too inspiring from qualifying. The last few matches have been a little bit better. They started the World Cup qualifying campaign with a couple wins. But I would say overall, the mood heading into the tournament is there's some cautious optimism, I think. But yeah, with Italy standing in the way, and then who knows how Wales are going to perform. But yeah, there's some worry that they may not even be able to make it out of the group stage at this point.
And obviously, looking at the squad, Petkovic is able to call on quite a bit of experience. Jan Sommer, Kevin Babu, Nico Elvedi, Manuel Akanji, Ricardo Rodriguez, who were all included in Euro 2016. And again, as I say, it wasn't the most exciting performance in terms of the Swiss team. And that sometimes can kind of lead you down the path of criticising teams because they have players who are performing in the Premier League or the Bundesliga. But being able to call on that amount of experience is a big, big plus for Petkovic.
Yeah, I think for sure there's guys who have been there, not only from the last World Cup in Euro, but even going back a couple more tournaments. Shaqiri obviously being the big one, but some of those other guys, lots of experience in the Bundesliga, in the Premier League, and I think that really forms the heart of the team. You know, Granit Xhaka in the midfield. I know he's had some ups and downs with his club, but for Switzerland, he really is kind of that driving force for them in terms of a defensive stopper, but also kind of setting up the play when they're moving the other direction. And I think too, some of the guys, it goes the other way too. There are some guys who have performed a little bit better for their club. So Haris Seferovic up front is a good example of that. I think at Benfica, people have been impressed with his play a little bit more over the last couple of years. But when it comes to playing for Switzerland, he really hasn't performed up to the level of a top striker. He doesn't produce the way that they need to really move on in these tournaments.
Xhaka and Shaqiri are the two names that jump off the page, particularly from a Premier League perspective. And we'll talk about Shaqiri in a second because his case is particularly unusual and potentially explosive in the tournament. Granit Xhaka, Arsenal fans need no reminder that, generally speaking, he's a walking yellow card or a walking red card. But as you say, for Switzerland, he seems to be a different beast. There's a little bit more calmness in his play and a little bit more maturity in terms of how he gets around the pitch and tries to influence matches. Are you confident that he can keep his temperament, keep his cool in a big tournament? Because in terms of his age, he's probably coming towards the second part of his international career. He doesn't know how many more tournaments he's got left in him. Him keeping it together and not just diving into a tackle could be the decisive factor between Switzerland winning a game or losing a game and potentially even getting out of the group.
Yeah, I think, I don't know why it is, but for some reason, when he's playing for Switzerland, he is calmer, and maybe it's taking on that leadership role for his country. But we don't see the same kind of problems that he has at Arsenal, where there, yellow and red cards all over the place. He does seem to be really more of a steadying force. He still has that passion and the fire, you can see for sure. And I think their game against Albania, where he almost set off an international incident at the last World Cup with his double eagle celebration, there is an example of that, where he can sometimes still go over the top. But overall, he is a much more calming force, I think, for the Swiss than maybe he is with the Gunners.
Jadon Shaqiri is another unusual case in terms of his role with the Swiss national side, and he's had even less of an impact with Liverpool this season than he did in the previous year. And his relationship with Switzerland and Petkovic has not always been fantastic. There was a long hiatus of about 18 months where it looked like he wouldn't play for Switzerland again. And if the tournament had been last summer when it was originally scheduled for, he probably wouldn't have participated. That hatchet does seem to have been buried between Petkovic and Shaqiri now. And before we talk about the impact that we're hoping to see him have on the pitch, what is the relationship between manager and, let's be frank about it, star player ahead of the tournament?
Yeah, it's for sure. It has been an issue. I think he was unhappy not to get the armband a couple of years ago, and when Stefan Lichtsteiner did. So that kind of created some problems, some trust issues maybe, and a feeling of him being a bit underappreciated. But at the same time, he hasn't always been the one to step up and really put in a performance when Switzerland needs it. Like, there are those great examples, for example, that the goal against Poland at the last Euro, where he has, but at other times he seems kind of disinterested and I sense there's some frustration from him, probably coming from his club play, not getting to play at Liverpool. It probably feels frustrating for him. And then in terms of how that spills over into his relationship with Petkovic and the national team, I'm sure he is hearing things like, you don't have the match fitness right now. You're not necessarily at the level we want you to be at. But I do get the feeling that at this point, probably again, moving towards kind of the second half of his career or already there, he probably feels like Switzerland has underachieved when they've had opportunities in the last 16, whether it's at Euro or World Cup. So it seems like he is kind of, as you said, willing to bury the hatchet, move on for the good of the team, and really refocus himself and deal with whatever he needs to with Petkovic on that side.
But match fitness obviously will be an issue for him. I'm just looking at his numbers here in terms of Liverpool heading into the tournament. And since March, he's played a grand total of 22 minutes spread across the Premier League and the Champions League. He came off the bench in both legs against Real Madrid. But that's not ideal preparation by any stretch of the imagination. And despite the talent that he's got and that ability to just create a moment of magic, set piece, or that unbelievable bicycle kick that you mentioned against Poland in Euro 2016, inevitably, if you're playing so little football, this is not a case of he plays the occasional game. He never plays for Liverpool. And Jurgen Klopp has admitted that he understands that he's frustrated, but his hands are essentially tied because of the situation that Liverpool find themselves in battling to get into the top four in the Premier League. But given all those variables thrown into the mix, Switzerland, Petkovic, all of the players, the Swiss fans, need a fit Shaqiri and a hungry Shaqiri this summer. Do you think that's what they're going to get?
I think they're going to get a hungry Shaqiri for sure. In terms of fitness, it kind of remains to be seen. He did play well in the two World Cup qualifying games over the last or a couple months ago now, I guess. But he did look pretty engaged. He scored for the first time in a couple of years for Switzerland against Lithuania. So I mean, even without the play at Liverpool, without the minutes, like I said, I think he realizes this may be one of his last or even his last chance with Switzerland to really make his mark. And so I think that he is for sure hungry and he'll be engaged from that perspective. But like you said, the match fitness is definitely a concern going into the tournament.
Goals is always a sticky or a sore subject with teams that have kind of had to battle their way through qualification. And that's definitely the case with Switzerland. Shaqiri, that we've talked about, is the second highest scorer in the history of the Swiss national side, 23 goals. And you have to go quite a way down from there to find someone else who's in the squad. Haris Seferovic, that you mentioned before, is kind of a goal every third or maybe even every fourth game for the national team. Breland Bolo, it's kind of flashes of brilliance or a key goal here and there, but without there being a regular output in front of goal. Is that going to be an issue for Switzerland, Seferovic and Bolo? Do you see them having enough about them to get key goals to get Switzerland out of the group?
Yeah, well, for sure. It has always been an issue for them. And I've been frustrated, and I think a lot of people have been, with Petkovic's willingness to stick with Seferovic through, I mean, it's going on 7 or 8 years. He's been kind of the first choice striker, but he's never really performed. Like, even the goals he has scored, he has one goal in major tournaments in his whole career, back in the 2014 World Cup, I think. So Seferovic, I mean, to my mind, is not the answer. Mbolo, I think, like you said, there's been flashes of brilliance. The biggest thing for him is he hasn't had the regular playing time with the national side. We talk about Shaqiri not getting the playing time with his club. Mbolo, even the appearances he's had, he's often coming off the bench, and then he does kind of really inject some pace into the game when he comes in. But it's only been really the last year or so that we've seen him be in the starting 11. And I think with that confidence and going into the tournament, there is a real opportunity for him to kind of step up and take that place as the guy who is providing the goals for Switzerland.
And if he's not able, or if Petkovic throws caution to the wind a little bit, Ruben Vargas is a potential option. 22 years of age, but he's only really come to the fore in the senior team in the last 12 to 18 months. And in terms of his return, particularly when you put it up against Seferovic or Mbolo at club level, he's got 6 goals for Augsburg this season, despite not being a regular. But he has scored for Switzerland in 2021 in the friendly game back in March. Could he be a possible option? I know you say that Petkovic is very committed to this system that he plays and to certain players, but if we're in a position after game 2 or game 3 where you need a goal and you need something to change, could he be a possible option off the bench?
Yeah, I think for sure. He did really impress again in those couple World Cup qualifying games, particularly against Lithuania, which they only won it 1-0. He was all over the pitch. He was creating opportunities. And they had problems getting people on the end of them again. Like, Seferovic missed a few good chances in that game, I think. But yeah, no, Vargas for sure has been, it would be another good option. And like you said, then he was rewarded the next game. He did score against Finland. And another guy I think who is kind of overlooked often with Switzerland is Mario Gervanovic, who plays for Dynamo Zagreb. And he's, every time he comes on the pitch for them, he's creating opportunities. He also scored in that game against Finland. And again, another guy who doesn't get to start very often, but whenever he's on the pitch, I've been really impressed with his play. And I think he's another guy kind of who could step up and provide some offense for them when they need it.
Predictions time, obviously Group A, Italy, you look at them as being the big hitters, but no qualification for the 2018 World Cup. Turkey and Wales, semi-finalists in 2016 for Wales, but they are a different beast depending on which way you look at it. They're arguably a better side this time round, but they're a less experienced side, whereas Petkovic has kept his crop together and they're a more experienced outfit. Are you confident of getting out of the group, and from there, do you think there's the possibility to push on?
I'm pretty confident that they will be able to get out of the group. Like I said before, there's been some worry, some talk. I mean, it's a little bit easier this year with the potential to qualify even from third place to get out of the group. But I think they should be able to. Like you said, Italy's obviously the favorite. That being said, the Swiss have a couple of recent examples of even taking down some of the giants in their group. In 2010, the World Cup, they beat Spain. In 2018, they drew Brazil in their first game. So I'm not necessarily going to put money on them beating Italy in Rome, but there's always that possibility. But then, yeah, I think when you get into Wales and Turkey, the Swiss should have their measure there. I think they should finish second in the group if they play up to their potential for sure.
And that brings to an end our Group A preview podcast. Matthew, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And next up, we're going to be previewing Group B. Don't forget to check that one out.